Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, a hot Nate Langston.
And me, Ian Morris. Did I hit the beat there?
I don't know. I was just thinking I needed to point out that by hot, I'm not alluding to my own state of physical attractiveness.
No.
I physically mean boiling hot, because it is something of a heat wave right now.
And we're recording this early as well, and it's still unbearably hot.
It is very, very, very hot. A few things came up in our pre-show, one of which is the presence of a rather pretty little brown spider on my desk. Now, the last that I saw of this spider was when he was making his way betwixt a shadow from my iPad and a glasses cloth. I haven't seen him since. I'm hoping he makes a return visit to the forefront of my desk. He may have gone in search of somewhere cooler. But we can't all...
Do spiders feel the heat? Because some of the hottest places in the world have really quite big spiders. So presumably that's just all win for them.
I assume spiders born in the tropical climes of Broxbourne are not going to be super thrilled about being particularly hot compared to their Australian brethren.
But I don't know how spiders operate, to be honest.
No. Well, we had an interesting tweet come in from last week's show about when we were talking about digital photo frames. Sean was, I assume, walking past the Jessops after listening to the show and had spotted not just that Jessops was selling its own digital photo frame in this, the year of our Lord 2022, but it had a promotion on for them, and there were two in the window. They are £60, Ian.
Wow.
For a Jessops photo frame. And if I
you could probably buy a TV for that, couldn't you?
At the picture, it looks like it's a 10-inch digital photo frame. Yeah. Not bad. So
definitely reckon you could get yourself on the internet, on the electronic bay, and purchase yourself a TV for around that kind of money.
You could. So not only are digital photo frames still a thing, but they are a thing enough that it is worth promoting them in the window of a high street retail outlet.
Very good tweet that, Sean. I like it when people send us related tweets.
I do. And yes, thank you. Well, a little later on, we're going to be talking about Laserdisc. You may wonder, why are we talking about something that was invented in the 70s and nobody buys anymore? The answer is because we want to. Because we want to.
Ruin it if we want to.
We'll talk about whatever we like. And this is the first thing we like. I did notice that ISP Review, one of my favourite websites, has said that BT had announced, so it's coming via two places here, that its fixed line network had recently hit a new peak. Now, Ian, I don't know if you've read the script in advance of this segment. Do you know what the new peak of BT was during its busiest hour on the fixed line network? So users of its...
I don't even know how that would be quantified.
Well, I'll tell you. It's 28 terabits per second.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that is an enormous amount. I mean, that as a figure, that doesn't mean a great deal to anyone, but I'll contextualize that in 2012, so 10 years ago, BT reported hitting 622 gigabits per second. Now, bearing in mind that there are about 1,000-ish gigabits within a terabit, we've gone from 622 gigabits in 2012 to 28, well, let's put it, you could say 28,000 gigabits per second. It's not strictly accurate, but it's an easier point of comparison.
That's a lot.
So it's increased a hell of a lot over the last 10 years. Might not be that surprising, but just sometimes seeing it written down in figures, it's like, huh, that's quite significant.
Yeah, I mean, was there a reason for this massive peak?
The only reason given is that people are using more data.
That's a really useless piece of information.
It is. I mean, if you want to look at that in numbers, I did actually look those up. Ofcom said that the average data volume per month for a house in Britain right now is just a hair under half a terabyte per month, which is about 453 gigabytes.
That's I mean, that alone is a staggering amount of data. I mean, obviously 99% of that is streaming video, I'm assuming.
Yes,
because
they didn't
think of anything else that would occupy so much broadband.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost certainly going to be all that. But you also have to look at things like the size of video games to download. You take a game like, I mean, you know, a few weeks ago we installed The Elder Scrolls Online on Kate's laptop. She's been playing that religiously, I'm pleased to say, over the last 6 weeks or so. And that's a 100 gigabyte download. And we downloaded it on one machine and then decided to use it on a different machine. So that's another 100 gigabyte download. So just setting Kate up to play that is 200 gig in one go.
Yeah. So, I mean, I noticed from my network usage stats that, and this won't be particularly reliable because I've also had to use Wi-Fi for various reasons. I can't get into that. It's too complicated. This says in the last 30 days, I've done 132 gigabytes on my PC. So that's not streaming video, which I imagine, because I'm using Sky Glass still, probably my monthly usage is insane. In fact, I think Virgin sends you an email about it. I should look that up and see.
Virgin used to send me emails. I mean, obviously, I'm not with Virgin anymore. But when they did send me emails, whenever I clicked on the link to view that data, it said it was never available. So I never actually got to benefit from that superbly useful bit of information.
It's classic Virgin, isn't it?
Yeah, it didn't work. I do know that I use several terabytes a month. On our home fiber, we're definitely an edge case just because of the amount of media that gets consumed, plus cloud backups. We have a lot of family members who use a shared server that's here in this office with me, so it's constantly in use. But for the average household, it seems pretty interesting that we're up to half a terabyte. If you're interested, I did pull up the figures for mobile usage, and I know you're interested in, so I'm going to wait for a response. The average usage per mobile data user right now is 4.5 gigabytes a month. So an exact tenth of what's being used in the home. But that is surprising to me that it's not higher. Because when you think about the amount of data that people use just taking photos and syncing them to the cloud, that's, I mean, I would have thought that'd be far, far higher.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
one minute of 60 FPS video on an iPhone is several hundred meg alone. So,
yeah, and I mean, because I obviously had to make the decision recently, didn't I, to go for a fixed amount of data on my mobile. So I now only have 100 gigabytes.
Mike points out in the live chat that he only syncs over Wi-Fi, and that's true. I suppose that is something a lot of people do. But
yeah, I just checked that link; it doesn't work.
You're the Virgin email. No, they never do. They never
do. Doesn't say anything. What's the point? God, they're awful.
I honestly, it's been like that for at least 2 years because I haven't been with Virgin for over a year, and those emails started about a year before I left, and they never worked then either. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
But absolutely ridiculous. Okay, fine. Let's move on.
So how much data do you use a month? Let us know. hello@uktechshow.com. I know that we have at least one listener who uses hundreds of gigabytes using a 3G connection. I want to say it's John. Might be Richard. Might be both of them.
I think it is John.
I think it's both.
It?
I think they both use that. But,
yeah.
But yes, I wanted to point something else out that I saw this week that intrigued me. It's not strictly tech, but is this podcast strictly a tech show anymore? Who knows? The name suggests so, but the content suggests otherwise. Cargo bikes. Do you know what these are?
No.
These are bicycles that have, imagine a handlebar mounted basket that just got out of hand. You know, basically you can fit a child or two in the front of instead of them. You see them in the city a lot, delivering fruit around to corporate boardrooms. Well, I did notice a story on The Guardian that people are buying a ton more of these things. The description The Guardian had was, cargo bikes usually feature a tub or platform that can be used to carry goods or people, balanced on two or more heavy-duty wheels. The Guardian story pictured a chap who actually sells these, and in the photo he was pushing his daughter and a dog somewhere, presumably a school for the daughter. I think the dog had already passed his exams. Though. Well, you never know. There are dog schools.
Well, they do have dog schools, yeah.
They do, but dogs tend not to do GCSEs. Although, that said, I don't remember doing many of mine. These are interesting little things, and they are rising, but I think they're rising largely in cities because they're probably cheaper to run than a car right now. But I did I did wonder, as a person who I know, Ian, has not one but two children, and has also put at least one of them in a ridiculous form of personal transportation over the years.
Yeah.
That little, what is it, electric Mercedes.
Electric Tesla. Tesla. That was great, that thing.
I did wonder whether you would consider getting one of these to take your wee nippers to the old exam centre.
It's well, I mean, bearing in mind I live 10 miles away from where they go to school, it's probably not a practical solution for me. But I like the idea of it. I mean, having kids on bikes is one of the most adorable things you can ever do. I mean, Izzy and Bob both loved being on the back of the bike with me. They had one of those little chairs, and they sort of bounce around in them because they're sort of attached by a strong but a bouncy arm. And it was always adorable having them on. They used to have the wildest time. It was great.
Ah, you mean the little sidecars? Yeah.
No. It's a seat. In fact, someone's posted in the chat a picture of a woman with a child seat on the back of her bike, and that's exactly what I had. That kind of thing.
Oh, so, I see.
I mean, I love the idea of having them up front. That's really nice, and it's probably a bit safer.
Well, I've always been terrified when I see people with a child on the back of a seat, because I think if you fall off, that child's head is going to have a very serious and not so casual relationship with the pavement.
You put a helmet on them.
Does that
you wouldn't do it with a baby. That helmet. Well, yes. I mean, the point is, you could, I suppose, theoretically fall off. The point is that you're always super careful when they're on. And I didn't used to do it on particularly busy roads. And they'd have a little helmet on so about to protect them. I'm sure I've got a picture of one of them somewhere. I'll just see if I can find it.
Oh, Nick in our live chat posted an interesting link to a BBC story that says Germany has a lot of these as well, and that sales are growing there too. It's quite interesting. A lot of these tend to be, you know, delivery things, and I think that a large part of the reason why people buy more of these is because they are cheaper to run in cities and easier to get around. But I do think that a lot of journeys done by cars can be replaced by bikes, and so why shouldn't these things be doing better? They're not particularly techie. I'd love them to be even more techie, because then we'd actually have a reason to talk about them, not because it was a week full of news that I really just don't think we care enough about to talk about. Fun stuff, there's some really important boring stuff going on, but we don't like talking about boring important stuff. We like talking about inconsequential fun things on this program, such as this. The bicycle news.
Okay.
Well, the third thing that stuck out to me this week, other than the little spider on my desk, which I'm increasingly concerned as to the whereabouts of, I hate the idea of accidentally killing something. And I don't know where he's gone. I really hope he makes a return visit.
Well, they're pretty resilient.
Yeah. it is Pocket Lint. This is the story. Pocket Lint wrote that mobile coverage on the Tube network in London here is expanding. Five additional stations are going to get access soon. However, the more important thing, I think, is that TfL, Transport for London, that is, also announced that Virgin Media and Vodafone, so that's Virgin Media O2 now, isn't it, and Vodafone have joined the rollout, which means that when the 4G, 5G rollout across the Tube line expands much more in earnest, people on 3EE, Vodafone and Virgin Media O2 are going to get 4G data. And to differentiate that from what people may have experienced already, this is not Wi-Fi on the platform. This is 4G and 5G in the tunnels while you're traveling on a train, which Ian and I are not in favor of at all, because we're grumpy and we routinely send each other angry tweets, and not tweets, messages about people having conversations about really quite personal things on trains. And the general rule applies. if I can hear you through my headphones that are noise cancelling and playing me Metallica, then you are speaking too loud. Simple as.
Do you remember when we were at CNET and I yelled at that man on the tube? I mean, you weren't there. It was on my way in. It's when I lived in Watford, and this guy was talking about getting a new front door or something, and he was talking about it very loudly for a really long time on the train. And I lost my rag. I completely lost my rag and just yelled, "Will you please shut up?"
I can imagine that.
For a lot of shocked looks. I can't remember if he did stop it or not, but it didn't matter. I'd said my piece by then and I was happy with that.
Did you sit down?
It really
down
is
looking
so
quite
inconsiderate.
It is. I know. I'm not in favour of this at all. Nick in the chat says if he was there, he would have been applauded. And I do know that my mum was once on a train, I think coming down to see me, and she always takes the quiet carriage. And there were people in there nattering insanely loudly. I mean, loudly enough that she'd ask them to maybe consider moving the carriage. And she did get a round of applause from other people in the carriage.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really, if there's a quiet carriage on a train, please, just be quiet.
The clue's in the name.
I mean, I think the thing is, there's nothing backing this up. Like, the guard won't tell people to stop talking. I mean, and I'll be honest with you. I have been someone who has been drinking on a train going to Edinburgh in what was notionally called the quiet carriage. So I might be as bad at this as everyone else, but that was many years ago.
There really should be a rule, shouldn't there, that if somebody is talking quietly and refuses to shut up, it should be permissible for two fellow passengers, as long as they hold a ticket for the same class of carriage, to lift the offending people up out of the seat against their will and throw them into another carriage or out of the window, as long as there is a soft landing area for them.
You know what? I'm going to agree with that. I feel at the very least we should allow we should encourage them to be asked to move. Like, the guard should come along and go, "Oh, let's quiet carriage. Can you just go
what
somewhere?"
Guard?
Else?
I've never seen a guard on a station. I took a video of somebody on a train the other day. Two people vaping quite blatantly and knowing that they were being watched.
Brilliant.
And I took a video of them and I was going to report it, and then I didn't because I was like, what's the point? There's enough evil in the world. But when I was walking home and deleted the video, I did think there are a lot of people who talk about the point of guards on trains and the importance of guards and conductors on trains. And I thought, where was the conductor? Why couldn't I have pointed to a conductor? Excuse me, you see those two people who are vaping with obnoxious clouds of smoke, which I find obnoxious even at the best of times out in a street and I'm walking behind somebody. But on a train, deliberately, I think there is a special place in hell for people like you.
Yes, I mean, that's quite inconsiderate, really, isn't it?
You're listening to Nate Langston's Soapbox, sponsored by Ian Morris. Remember when this was a tech show?
No, not really. It's always been a bit of a disaster, to be honest. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, you know, we're both unhinged in our own separate ways.
It's true. Like many of the doors when we bought this house. Because the chap who put them up couldn't do a good enough job. In fact, one of the hinges only had one screw in it. Supported four. Obviously saved a bit of money by using three fewer than he needed to. But
As someone who recently... Well, when I bought my Samsung TV, it came with only two screws of the required four to mount it to its stand.
Broken Britain,
and so I just went ahead and did it with two screws because, you know, what's the problem?
That's how you got your nickname, isn't it? Two Screws Morris. That'd be your prison name.
But then I've mounted it on a very nice floor-standing stand now. Which is really nice, and it's I use it for driving simulators. It sits in front of my wheel and chair. It's pretty nice.
It's been a long time since I've watched anything on TV because all Kate and I do, instead of watching TV or films, is play The Elder Scrolls. Or I'm listening to audiobooks. I'm actually working my way through a 50-hour biography of Hitler and the rise and fall of the Third Reich, which is testing. It's very, very interesting, but it's difficult. I'm interested in in people like that. Not just Hitler. I'm interested in all of history's many bastards. Anyway, here comes some music, and after which, speaking of, we're going to get to Ian's story. Ian, I sent you a script this week for something I'm working on.
Yes.
At Bloomberg, which I'm not going to talk about.
Yes.
But I will point out that I filmed it on Thursday, and I cannot wait for it to come out. It's going to be amazing. But I was talking to Ian about this, and the topic of that episode made Ian and I talk about Laserdisc. And I pondered, what would it have been like if Laserdisc had have really taken off? Like, would the state of the earth today, at least as far as video formats are concerned, would it be radically different to what came before it? Because VHS was the thing that Laserdisc competed with, right? Mm. So I posed this question to Ian. I said, Ian, and he said, yes, Nate. And I said, are you cool for podcasting on Sunday? And he said, yes. And then I texted him again a little later and said, Ian, and he said, yes, mate. I said, what would have happened if Laserdisc had have won the format wars? And he said, good question. And I now present to you, ladies and gentlemen, Ian's funny answer.
Well, I mean, it's not funny, really. But then I would say that, you know, the world might have been very different. I mean, a lot of our listeners probably might not be that into Laserdisc, or might not even really have that much awareness of it. I mean, people are young these days. A lot of them probably haven't even heard of Laserdisc. I'll give you some context. In the 80s and 90s, VHS was a, you know, pretty popular home format. You could record on it, which was convenient. People had them and Betamax decks sometimes in their own homes to capture things off the TV. But there was no DVD, obviously. That didn't come around till, 1998, 1999, and didn't become popular until into the 2000s. Previously, there was a much larger size disc, a 12-centimetre disc, the sort of size of a vinyl. And on it, they put analog video, and it was called a Laserdisc. And it was a really fantastic format. And I suppose if it had been more popular, it might have changed the landscape a bit. If people had routinely had lots of Laserdiscs, there's a possibility that they would have just made Laserdiscs digital, and they would have been maybe back compatible. You know, you bought a new digital Laserdisc player maybe, and it would have played all your old analog Laserdiscs. Who knows? It could have been a completely different world, and we would still be using massive discs instead of sort of CD size things. That said, of course, the CD was already a thing by the time Laserdisc was a thing, so your music would have already been on a small disc. So it sort of kind of makes sense that it would have gone the CD route rather than the Laserdisc route. But for those people who were very into owning movies in the sort of 80s and 90s, Laserdisc was the format. It could hold a full quality PAL image or NTSC. So instead of VHS, which had around half the amount of information as of a broadcast TV signal, a Laserdisc had the full signal. So they looked a lot better. They were sharper. They had, you know, better colour reproduction, all that kind of stuff. You know, a genuinely very nice format. There were sort of two main competing formats. One of them could store about 30 minutes per side of video, which is not a lot, which meant that if you were watching a sort of two-hour film, you would have to, not only would you have to switch the side that you were watching, you'd also have to switch discs, so you would go through probably four discs for a two-hour film, and then maybe another disc for any special features that you might have included. So, but there were two sort of different formats. One of them was called constant angular velocity, or CAV, and you could store around 30 minutes of video per side. Constant angular velocity means that the disc would spin at the same speed no matter where the laser was. There was a second format which allowed you to fit more video on, and it made use of the fact that the tracks on the outer edge of the disc were longer, so you could have more information on them. So that as the laser moved out reading the disc, the disc would slow as you got further out, so you could store more on it. So the first format, 30 minutes per side, the second 60 minutes per side, and then later on there was a special Pioneer thing. And you've got to remember, Pioneer were the Laserdisc people.
You might say they were the pioneers.
You might indeed say that. There were other companies involved in Laserdisc, but Pioneer were the... If you like Laserdisc, you probably have a Pioneer player, because they were great. And they had a thing later on that was called CAA, and it was a sort of a better... It provided better picture quality, and it was, you know, sort of a kind of a merging of the two standards. You could have CD quality sound on a Laserdisc, which was something that was... I mean, arguably a bit better than VHS. VHS sound is actually quite good. It's hi-fi quality is what they used to say. We used to record overnight radio on VHS tapes. It was quite common because they would run for a very long time and the quality was very high. A little bit of trivia for you there. But also you could have digital audio on a Laserdisc. So Dolby Digital first became a thing on Laserdisc. And you could have like surround sound, and it was very impressive. And that was a real thing. Unfortunately, this is towards the end of the life of Laserdisc. So people were already getting DVDs by this point, but the sound quality on Laserdiscs could be phenomenal. It was a really nice way to get into proper surround sound that wasn't Pro Logic, which is kind of a kludge and worked, but didn't sound brilliant for surround sound.
Is it essentially then that Laserdisc was superseded by DVD?
Yes.
Not really that it was beaten out by VHS, because VHS
exactly.
was not the spiritual successor to Laserdisc. They coexisted.
They coexisted. They evolved at the same time. You know, so Laserdisc was sort of starting in the early 80s, and VHS was already sort of a thing by then. So it was a good way for people who really love movies to get a better quality. If you had a projector in the early days, you know, one of those old CRT things with three big lamps on the front, you know, a red, green and a blue, that would have cost tens of thousands of pounds. So if you were super rich, you would not have considered using VHS for that. It would have had to have been Laserdisc, and even then the quality wouldn't have been brilliant. It sort of evolved at the same time. It was very much a niche format because of that, for that very reason. People had VHS decks, so there wasn't really a lot of reason for them to move to Laserdisc, apart from the sort of jump in quality and the fact that they have the same appeal as a vinyl. You know, you get these beautifully prepared packages, the discs are inside, they have, you know, lovely cover art, and it's big so you can see it, it's really nice. You'd have maybe a booklet inside, and some of those discs these days, thinking back about Jurassic Park was released on Laserdisc, you'd probably spend quite a lot of money getting one of those discs now. The original Star Wars, before George Lucas came along and redid all the special effects and annoyed everyone by what's his face shooting first, that was a really nice way to see Star Wars in quite high quality, whereas previously it was sort of on VHS. So people would, I think anyone who'd ever seen a Laserdisc or used one or held one would be quite fond of it. It was a really lovely format. Unfortunately, it was big, it was kind of clunky, it was never particularly affordable. And then DVD came along and just completely ate its lunch, because it offered digital video at the same sort of quality, maybe, possibly slightly better, and generally it was just a million times more convenient. And of course we had games consoles appearing, so they were all, you know, moving towards using CDs and DVDs for data storage, so that completely sort of tips the scales, really. But
so really, to answer the opening question, what would have happened if Laserdisc won, I suppose in many ways the answer is exactly what did happen, because they would inevitably have gone digital and gone smaller, and that's basically what a DVD was, with the bonus being that you don't have to flip a DVD over to watch the second half of a movie, although that did happen a lot. You did get dual-sided discs.
You did, in fact. a lot of the early discs were flippers, as they were called. I remember having Armageddon, the movie, as a flipper DVD, and then Warner Brothers got so much hassle for it that they reissued it as a dual layer disc, and then you could send back your flipper and get a dual layer, which I did, which was quite good, really.
Did they ever release Flipper on a flipper?
No, I don't believe they did.
Did they ever release Flubber on a flipper?
Good question. Would have been about the right time.
It would have been.
I don't remember. You've got to remember, I think, is Flubber a Disney film?
I have no idea, mate. Flubber, I mean, it was a fine film, but it's no Casper the Friendly Bloody Ghost.
Disney were notoriously troublesome when it came to DVDs and things like that. They didn't really like releasing things on the format. They've always been a bit of a holdout to physical media, partly because they like to control things. You may remember that there was the thing called the Disney Vault, so you could buy a movie for a very limited amount of time and then it would just be deleted and you wouldn't be able to buy it anymore, and so you'd either have to have it or you wouldn't ever own it. It was remarkable.
And the two other things I thought I would mention: VHS, obviously, you could record to at home, which was not possible on Laserdisc.
As far as I know, no one ever did a recordable Laserdisc. I just don't think that was possible.
However, Nick points out in our chat room something I completely forgotten about, which is the BBC did in the 1980s release the Doomsday Project, which was a digitized version of the Doomsday Book as of William the Conqueror, released it on Laserdisc, pioneering it was at the time. And I went to see one of these because they did an event. I think I was at Wired at the time.
Oh, really?
They did an event where they'd brought together some of the original Doomsday systems, and there was only about 1,000 of them made, according to this BBC story we're looking for, and I got to use one. I'll try and find my Wired story at the time, but I went and talked to the people who worked on it and got to see one in use, and it was honestly the only time, first and last time, I've ever seen a Laserdisc in person, and it was for this Doomsday thing. So I'll put a link to that along with all the things we talked about, as always, in the show notes at uktechshow/episodes. This is episode 281 for those of you who wish to find those links. And if you have any thoughts, memories, hopes, dreams, wishes, requests, whatever, about the wonderful world of Laserdisc or anything else we talk about, you know what to do.
We didn't even get to high definition video on VHS in that segment. That's another one.
We didn't. And thanks to Nick, who just pointed out that the Wired podcast episode 24, we talked all about the my visit to see the Laserdisc, which I'd forgotten I'd recorded. So we'll include a link to that if you want to go and listen to me like 10 years ago or something talking about Laserdisc on another podcast. In fact, I might listen to that later because it's probably quite interesting. I'll include a link to that as well in the show notes. And thank you. If you're one of our patrons, of course, you're about to hear our next story. And I'm not going to spoil the surprise. I'm just going to play some music before we get into it. Charlotte gave us a bit of feedback this week after last week's discussion about email signatures. In fact, she posted this in our Discord along with a picture of her walking her cat through a forest, which I have to say is one of the best things I've ever seen. I don't think it's going overboard to say that walking a cat through the trees, I mean, how could you beat that other than two cats? Or, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
the cat can speak. It's just amazing. But
it's delightful. It's very difficult to have too much cat in your life.
Certainly is. Charlotte goes on to the body of her her message, which is in response to our question about how much data is too much data in an email signature, what I would call a prototypical text message question to the audience. She says, "Sorry, Nate, I have a long signature, my name, then my pronouns, linked to an article explaining why that's helpful to those in the trans and non-binary communities. Then, if it's internal, a call out to colleagues to sign up to be a careers champion and get involved in school activities in their community. Then lastly, an image explaining that we have won an award for diversity this year, which is incredible considering the amount of nepotism that goes on. But there are a few of us who care about equality and inclusion, so I share it anyway." They all seem perfectly reasonable, and I would say very standard in the world of corporate e-signatures. I don't have, I say an objection, it's not my, I have no right to have an objection to any of those, but they don't sound obnoxious, which is what I really object to.
No, and I mean, I think the big problems that we have are things that are designed to tell us how to live our lives. Don't print this email. Don't lick a hub cap on a car. That kind of thing. I mean, obviously, that doesn't happen very often.
I tell you, I tell you something, mate. I'm going to add that to my email signature. Nate Langson, so, editor, Bloomberg Technology, phone number. Don't lick the hubcap of a car.
Yeah. That's good advice. People might think that's helpful to them.
Yeah. Well, if that is helpful to you listening, I sincerely hope you seek medical advice both before and after considering licking the hubcap of a car. Nick asks, "And what if I don't want to mind the gap?" And anyone who is disembarked at Bank Station in London... noticed that the severe curvature of that platform makes those gaps particularly problematic. We'll know that that is a particularly facetious comment of Nick's, and he was right to make it. Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, everyone who's listening. Thank you, patrons. I'd like to welcome Ed McCloskey, who has joined us this past week. Thank you, Nick. Ed, rather. I mean, thank you, Nick. He's a patron as well. But also thank you, Ed. It's lovely to have you. And I don't have anything else really to point out other than I hope everybody has a marvellous week. It's been a great pleasure. I did want to point out that actually Ian did an extra message for patrons this week. Would you like to remind people what that was about?
It was me getting very angry about how I can't watch 4K streaming services on my computer, my lovely expensive computer.
Yeah. Kate and I listened to that when I was proofing the edit, and we both agreed it was absolutely very adequate.
That's what I strive for, total adequacy.
No, it was great. It was absolutely great. As a slight side note, that's got nothing to do with technology, I came up with something really fun while I was in the bathroom yesterday. I was doing a crossword, and I realised that huge amounts of a crossword, if you take many two or three interlocking words, you get some terrific potential names for experimental indie bands. And I wondered if, just before I play the outro to this, if you'd like to hear of some of the genuine indie band names that I came up with as a result of looking at interlocking words on the crossword yesterday.
And love,
I'm going
to.
Yeah, I'm going to say these while we fade out the music. Here they come. Barbaric shoe shingles. Vulgar excuse. Terrapin chair treason. Shoe shrapnel. Oval cornea. Full-time titanium seatbelt. Jack Russell faction. Sardine dentist. Shanty forceps. Landing gear eyesore. Excess Ian Cinema. Excess Ian Cinema. Standard pomegranate exam. Trout pea shooter. Burden grotto. Toddler acne. Toddler acne. Kneecap hypermarket. Kitchen bayonet. Cautionary kitchen attack. Limb
That's
critic.
The one. Cautionary kitchen attack is the one.
Air raid pundit. Extreme broccoli upset. Finally bankrupt Martin. Massage marathon. Almond titan. Bicycle lipstick. Caledonian. I have to stop this. Caledonian nasal dilemma. You've been listening to Text Message. See you next week, everybody.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.